You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia, brought to you by iWalkUp, flexible loans built for small businesses. Today, we are in Padova.
Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spicudeci cora, non spicudeci cora. Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spicudeci cora.
Where are we, Lionel?
Well, we're in Padova, Richard, the scene of more courtroom drama, cycling-related courtroom drama, than Perry Mason. Ali McBeal, you're probably an Ali McBeal sort of man, aren't you, Daniel? That's more your kind of thing.
No, but I used to live in Padova. I'm surprised to see you appearing on the podcast today, the Prince of Savoy. For anyone who didn't tune in yesterday, I am now lobbying for Lionel to be exiled, like the House of Savoy when Italy was made a republic in 1946, because of accompanying Arrosticini with aioli.
Not again, Daniel. I mean,
well, you're never going to live this down. I can get at least 3 days out of this controversy.
Extraordinary, extraordinary culinary elitism this is.
Actually, not. I hate to gang up, Lionel, on you.
But you're going to.
I really do. But I had a message as well from a chap called Jonathan Lomax, who said that he was shocked to hear Lionel Burney putting pecorino in his pasta alla norma.
Oh, that's incorrect.
He says,
incorrect.
In Tooting, you'll always get ricotta salata.
Oh yeah. Well, if he'd listened, he would have known that it was not possible.
Don't insult the listeners.
It was not possible.
The listeners
to
are
get.
Always right. You can insult Daniel and me all you like, but the listeners are always right.
He would have known that we couldn't get ricotta salata during lockdown, unfortunately. So pecorino is an acceptable enough substitution, really.
Okay.
So
Since it's the time for culinary confessions, I must admit that I think I made a terrible gaffe by saying that lasagna is from Ravenna. I haven't really found any documentary evidence of this. I mean, it's from there or thereabouts. Anyway, you're never going to believe this, but there's been beef in Italy for several decades about where lasagna actually comes from. And
Lovely beef in lasagna.
Well, we're going to Padova, and in that neck of the woods, it's not even really called lasagna. It's called pasticcio, which just means like a big mess of pasta. That's what people call it up there.
Lionel, you were shaking your head there.
Well, I'd already researched this about lasagna, but Daniel's done the sort of Weasley thing of correcting himself before somebody else can point out his mistake. So all my research this morning has gone to waste. But I was enjoying. I was looking forward to pointing out that Daniel was wrong about something.
oh dear, it's all getting very frayed, isn't it? As we reach the end of week two of our Giro. Thank God we're not in the same room. That's all I can say.
Just a serious point about the sort of travel around Italy, picking up. You know, I'm like a culinary magpie. I pick up little bits here and there, and then I bring them back to Not Watford, and I take what I enjoy and
put a big dollop of mayonnaise on top or salad cream.
Not salad cream. Salad cream. Goodness me. It improved The Abruzzese people could learn a thing or two. Their rather bland lamb kebabs were improved immeasurably by aioli.
Oh, what's coming up in today's episode, please, Daniel?
Well, Rich, a relatively flat stage. We're going from Ravenna in Emilia-Romagna to Padova in the Veneto, and we're going via the Colli Euganei, which are a range of hills outside Padova. Why are we going there? Well, on the 21st of February, the first person to die in Italy from coronavirus, unfortunately, did so in a place called Vaux, in the Colli Euganei. That was one of the first two places in Italy where there were outbreaks. Well, towards the end of February, the other one was Codogno in Lombardy. Vaux since then has, well, it sort of went into isolation, isolated itself immediately, and since then has been a bit of a sort of test case for the rest of Europe. There are some really interesting studies going on there that are being referred to and used, serving as an important reference point all over the world for how to contain the virus. Again, sort of in keeping with this theme we've had during our Giro of Italy getting back on its feet, really, after the coronavirus. Another place to mention in that range of hills, a range of volcanic hills outside Padova, is a beautiful little village called Arqua Petrarca. It was the home of the famous Italian poet Francesco Petrarca, Petrarch in English, and one of the founders of the Italian language, Lionel, in the early Italian Renaissance. You know, one of your predecessors, you've heavily influenced the Italian language in recent times, but Petrarch, Dante and Boccaccio are widely considered to be the inventors of Italian.
But what have we got? Sorry.
But what have we actually got in the podcast? Well, there was a link. We are unfortunately talking about coronavirus today. And we're talking about that moment in time. So I said the first person in Italy died on the 21st of February. Professional cycling was pretty much carrying on as normal around that date. The UAE Tour was about to start on the 23rd of February. Start it did, but it did not finish. So we're going to be hearing from someone who was at the UAE Tour and remained in the UAE for a very long time as a result of the coronavirus crisis. And we're also going to be hearing from the last race winner, or the last important race winner before cycling went into lockdown. So that is Max Schachmann, the German national road race champion, who won, of course, Paris-Nice.
Before we hear from him, could we have the tale of the tapa, please, Lionel?
Indeed, Richard. Yes, stage 13 of our Giro from Ravenna to Padova. I was really taken by Ravenna last year, Daniel. We had a very nice evening there, didn't we? Went for a run around the town. Really suddenly felt like proper Italy to me once we reached that point, or the kind of the more holidaymakers Italy. I mean, Ravenna is obviously a very popular a destination for people going on holiday. Shocked to see that in today's stage, which is 188 kilometres, it's absolutely flat as a piadina sandwich flatbread all the way to the 135 kilometre-ish mark. And then RGT cycling stage, the bit that we'll be riding, is like, well, three jagged volcanoes, mini volcanoes, 500 metres of climbing in 31.6 kilometres. And then we bail out at the top of the final climb, and then it's all downhill and flat to the line. I mean, you're just a sadistic race director, Daniel, choosing the hardest parts of the course every single day, even on what is basically a completely flat stage.
Horrible man. Another day in the saddle for us convicts of the road. Although I must confess, as Ciro might say, I've managed to get parole or something. I'm still in Cesenatico. I'm a day behind. I've been dropped. I'm off the back of our Giro. I couldn't keep up. Had to skip a day. And it's Friday now, and I'm trying to get myself back in contention. It may be too late, I fear. But we've done the main climb. This is the sound, my friends, of freewheeling. A rare treat on today's stage. But lots more stages and lots more climbing for me over the next few days, I fear.
Well, it's a bloke leaving Michele Ferrari's house on a what looked like a Celeste Bianchi bike.
Wow, steady on. We don't want people to draw any conclusions as to who's visiting Dr. Michele Ferrari. Right,
it definitely wasn't anyone in team kit, was it, Lionel?
But do you think that was him?
I'm not sure. I think he's going at a decent old clip there, Lionel. He might be in Rovigo by the time we catch up with him.
Oh, what a shame. I'm sure he'd wanted to chat, meet the cycling podcast.
All dressed in black, wasn't he?
Well, oh, that's so frustrating. We might have just seen him. We were, what, 75 metres away?
Definitely in his house. Can only have been his address.
Do you think he's going to the start?
Not impossible. No answer, Lionel, at the moment.
Well, he's gone off on his bike to the start of the stage.
Maybe we should get back in the car.
Chi è?
Buongiorno, c'è Michele?
No.
Ah, ho capito.
Chi è?
Sono un giornalista, stavo qua per il Giro d'Italia, quindi...
No, mi dispiace, non c'è perché fuori in bicicletta.
Ho capito, va bene.
Il Giro d'Italia non interessa, grazie.
Ho capito, grazie.
Buongiorno.
Well, Daniel, what did she say?
Well, she said, hello, buongiorno. She asked who it was. I didn't reveal that we were from the cycling podcast. I just said, Is Michele around? We suspected it was him, didn't we, leaving the house about, 200 metres ahead of us as we walked up to his house, leaving on his bike, and she indeed confirmed that, said that he was out training. Not just that he was out for a pootle on his bike line, Michele Farah was training this morning.
You don't think he's gone to the start?
Well, no, because the lady we spoke to, I presume might be his wife, said that the Giro d'Italia does not interest them.
Interesting. Well, Daniel, the route today takes us one way or another past Ferrara, the home of Dr. Michele Ferrari, and we went and doorstepped him. Well,
did you? All that grousing about the climbs in the second half of today's route or towards the end of the stage today, you could have popped into Michele's on the way and stopped.
It was the night
up
before I really needed to drop in and pay him a visit, I think. And this is an unfortunate segue, and there's no link here at all, but any update at all on the cheating, the allegations of cheating on the Our Giro on RGT?
No, Rich, but we're going to be exploring this in the next few days, aren't we? We're going to dedicate...
Investigating, I think, is the word. Investigating.
Well, we're going to be investigating it over the next few days. It's going to be a bit of a inquest into what's been going on in our Giro, allegations of cheating, controversy. A controversy that sort of spans much of Europe, I think. There are people of varying nationalities, different nationalities involved. There's a Frenchman involved, a Belgian. It's a good old-fashioned cycling e-doping scandal, potentially.
Do you feel allegedly you've made it as a race director now, that you've got a controversy on your hands?
Yeah, something for me to really get my teeth into finally, Rich, I would say.
The stage itself, obviously going past, more or less past the doorstep of Dr. Michele Ferrari, and then ending in Padova, Daniel. I mentioned at the start the scene of more courtroom drama than you can shake a stick at. It was... Well, the investigation into Dr. Michele Ferrari was based in Padova, wasn't it? And it went on for years, and you know, documents and phone taps and riders were caught in the Dr. Ferrari network. Well, the investigation went on for a long time, and several riders were banned as a result when it was proven that they had worked with Dr. Michele Ferrari, who was banned from working in the sport at the time. So, this is the stage of scandal, and we have our own scandal to investigate. Quite fitting.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia, brought to you by iWaka, flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Big thanks to our headline sponsor, iWaka. And as we said in last night's podcast, iWaka has been accredited by the British Bank to offer CBILS, that's the Coronavirus Business Interruption Loan Scheme, designed to help businesses weather the current crisis with a loan on which the first year's interest is covered by the government. iWaka have lots of satisfied customers, people who have been able to grow or develop their businesses with the help of a loan, including people whose businesses are in the cycling industry. Let's hear from one of them now.
Hi, my name is Mike Mooney. I run Hub Velo in Hackney, London. Probably much like any other small companies, cash flow is always an issue, especially in the cycling world, because it's very seasonal. So obviously in the spring and summer is a great time. Everyone wants to get on their bikes, they're riding, they're racing, they just want to be out, they're on holiday. And then in the winter month, business just drops off. Like it gets to the end of November and it's just like falling off a commercial cliff. Everything stops. It's very difficult to kind of maintain the business. We have the same staff, we have the same space, we have the same outgoings. So it's always very difficult to do that, to maintain the business with obviously a decreased amount of income. But we've managed to always work around it. Historically, the banks have not been as flexible as we would like them to have been. And then it all went pretty much kind of, I guess, digital and a bit faceless. And we didn't really have anyone that we could communicate with that understood us people. And then I found out about iWaka. I found them online. I'd read a couple of reviews, decided to get in contact with them. And they had everything that I didn't have from the bank. And I had someone that I could talk to. They understood our business. They were young. They were keen. They really wanted to help. It felt like the perfect partnership. It's just been great. I mean, we've got our first chunk of cash. We don't have an enormous amount of money with iWaka. We don't really need an enormous amount of money. It's just to tide us over through that, as I say, that difficult period in the winter. I actually have a relationship with iWaka. Someone I can talk to. I know them. I've been to see them. They ride bikes. They're young. They're dynamic. They're all the things that we didn't have before that we wanted. And that relationship has continued. And that's been really helpful for us.
Ciro Dream Team with Ciro Scognamiglio.
Dear listeners, well, obviously, Vincenzo Nibali. I choose the shark not because he's a serial Grand Tour winner, not at all. Who cares? The real reason is that I'm considered in the world of cycling is a shadow, but it's not true. He is my shadow. He follows me everywhere. We have an agreement. He knows that he never has to ask me to write a book about him. Never. David Luxton, are you listening to me? Never a book on Vincenzo Nibali. Otherwise, I will interrupt immediately our relation and I will cancel his telephone number from my smartphone. Imagine your listeners, who cares about writing books and writing books on the shark?
Well, Ciro Scognamiglio there with his latest pick, his latest selection for Ciro's Dream Team. No surprise at all to see Vincenzo Nibali in his lineup, is there?
I wouldn't have thought so. I'm very intrigued by the what kind of alchemy Ciro thinks he's going to be able to create between Mark Cavendish, who else we got in there? Elia Viviani, Radio Viviani, of course, Nibali.
Filippo Pozzato.
Pozzato, yeah, it could be a bit of an incendiary mix, I fancy.
I think Ciro cares about that. I mean, he's not really picking these guys for how they'll perform on the road, I don't think, is he? As a team, as a unit.
He'll have loads of stories for the team website, won't he?
And Contador as well. Let's not forget Alberto Contador's in there too. Fantastic. But Nibali is one of the few kind of big name riders who has said, in reaction to the revised calendar that's been announced, that he will ride the Giro d'Italia. He wants to ride the Giro. The Giro has kind of missed out because riders like Simon Yates, Romain Bardet, who were going to target the Giro when the revised calendar was announced, immediately said they were going to go to the Tour de France instead. And Nibali is, well, I think the only sort of big name at the moment who has said that he will target the Giro, which will be in October if things go according to plan. And in this episode, we're going to be talking, aren't we, about coronavirus and how it's impacted the cycling world, why we're in this situation that we're in at the moment. And we're going to speak to a couple of people from the world of professional cycling affected in different ways. Max Schachmann, really in the form of his life, won Paris-Nice. And we're going to hear from him about that win. He's the last winner of a World Tour race at the moment. And Andrea Agostini, the chief operating officer at Team UAE, or UAE Team Emirates, as they're known, who was caught up at the UAE Tour and fell ill himself, didn't he? And then ended up being sort of stuck in the UAE for quite a long time. So you've spoken to both of them, Daniel.
Yes, Rich. As I mentioned, if you go back to the week before the UAE Tour was supposed to start on the 23rd of February. So the week before, still no one had died in Italy. But then there was this football match that we discussed a few weeks ago, which has been described in various places as a biological bomb between Atalanta, the Bergamo team, and Valencia, the San Siro. 40,000 fans from Bergamo went there. And you know, whether that sort of catalyzed the spread of the virus has not been proven, but that's certainly one theory. But anyway, so that was the 19th of February. UAE Tour was starting on the 23rd of February. And at that point, Max Schachmann thought he was about to go and race in Italy as well. He was down to do Tirreno Adriatico. But as we're about to hear Andrea Agostini's plans in late February, and Max Schachmann's were about to be turned upside down.
We went to UAE Tour the 20th of February in Europe. Started to talk about this kind of virus. So honestly, we didn't know exactly what kind of virus was. And just a couple of days later, we got Dubai. We understood about the situation in Italy and this kind of virus. Honestly, we didn't know exactly how was the situation. Honestly, we aren't really worried about that.
Like, I was planned to go to Italy, to Strada and Tirreno. Of course, I also followed all the news, and it was like every hour something happened, something changed already. And I was like, oh, should I go to Italy? I don't know if it's the smartest idea. And it was like 3 or 4 hours before my plane departed to Italy. My spot director called me and said, stay at home. We don't want to have you in Italy. Better stay at home. And if Paris-Nice takes place, we're gonna get you there and you race in Paris-Nice. And that's what happened. I stood at home and then I booked myself a train ticket to Paris. Then did the other part of the story, you know already what happened.
We had, after a couple of days when the race started, a case of flu. We understood, we thought it was a flu, a normal flu, and we isolated the member of the staff immediately, like a protocol. But in that situation, our team doctor thought that could be talking about every day the situation, the virus and so on. He preferred to have a double check, and we sent the member staff to the hospital in Dubai. They said, "Bye, it's just a flu. After 2 days, maybe it could be a virus. After 3 days, now maybe it's a false positive." So we hadn't the real status of the member staff. One in the beginning, and after a couple of days, another member got ill in the last day. I mean, before moving to Abu Dhabi after the second Jebel Afit stage that we won with Tadej Pogacar. When we got Abu Dhabi in the hotel, rumors going to spread about the stop of the race the day after because of some cases of coronavirus in the peloton. But during the night, we got the news about the stop of the race, and the day after, everybody got a swap from the organization. In our case, we were all the new team were negative. And we were free to leave the hotel. That was on Friday, 28th, exactly. It was the first swap. We got the result 30 hours later. So during the night of Saturday, they informed us that we were all negative and we were free to leave the country. We had a meeting. During the meeting, we discussed between us what was the best solution for us and our team principal, Mauro Zanetti. And he said, "Guys, I know that we are free, we are all negative, but we never know because we got some information about this kind of virus. We know that it could be an incubation of 2 weeks. So it's better if we put ourselves in a self-isolation. We can have another swap in a couple of days and we see it's for our family and so on." In the first moment, you know, we want to leave and we want to go home, but we decided together that what he said, the Mauro Zanetti, was maybe the best solution for our family. And we started our self-isolation, our quarantine, voluntary quarantine. The 1st of March, after a couple of days, we repeated the swap, and me and the other team member were positive. In that case, even if I was completely asymptomatic, I mean, I got a couple of line of fever, my 37.2, 37.3 for 2 days, but no symptoms, no problem, no cough, breath problem. A lot of us were completely asymptomatic, but with the rules of Abu Dhabi, they put real isolation in the hospital.
It's really strange to think back to that time, late February, early March, because as you mentioned earlier, Daniel, professional cycling was carrying on as normal. I was in Belgium for Het Nieuwsblad and Kerner Brussels Kerner, and I've spoken to a few people who were there at the same time, and we were all pretty blasé about it. You know, there were reports coming out of Italy about serious outbreaks there, but there wasn't really a sense that Europe was about to shut down at all. And it was probably a few days later that talk about postponing or cancelling Strade Bianche became serious. But it was a real sort of creeping thing, wasn't it, at that point? And it is strange to think back to a very recent time, but a time that now I can sort of recognise our heads, our minds were in very different places.
Yeah, and we were aware to varying degrees about what was happening in the UAE. We knew that the likes of Andrea, but also, you know, lots of riders. So the Groupama riders, for example, and there were lots of others as well. They were, they'd either tested positive, as was eventually the case with Andrea, or they were still kind of locked down, self-isolating as a kind of precautionary measure. But there wasn't that much information about how they were going to get home, when they were going to get home, or their condition. I mean, by this point, we knew that Fernando Gaviria and Max Richese were potentially involved as well. I mean, both of those two have spoken about what happened to them since. And
Richese,
he's actually admitted that Gaviria had given... Well, he thinks that Gaviria gave him the virus. It was a bit of a joke one day. Gaviria sort of snatched a bottle of lemonade or a can of Coke off him and then gave it him back. And Gaviria, about half an hour later, started to feel ill. And those two, they're pretty sure that that's what happened, that Gaviria transmitted the virus. Gaviria's was profusely apologetic, obviously, afterwards. But, you know, they ended up being stuck in the same situation as Andrea Agostini. So they eventually tested positive and were stuck in hospital. And, yeah, in the meantime, you know, I was looking forward to Paris-Nice. It was going to be my first race of the season to cover. And teams were pulling out in the days before Paris-Nice. And right up until the day when we travelled, we didn't know whether the race was going to take place. And then there was a fairly dramatic, I suppose, eve of the race in a place called Plaisir in the southern suburbs of Paris, when, you know, it's usually a routine director sportifs meeting before the race. But as we arrived and we saw the director sportifs arriving, we quickly figured out that this wasn't a routine meeting. A lot of the director sportifs were actually there with a fairly sort of open mind, or not having decided completely whether their teams were going to race Paris-Nice or how much of Paris-Nice they were going to do. And the outcome of that meeting, and there were also meetings with UCI medical people and the race doctor, the outcome was that all of the teams that had travelled to Paris-Nice were going to start. But, you know, it was very uncertain. We didn't know whether we'd be able to interview riders. As it turned out, we could most of the time, but there were some teams who wouldn't give any interviews. And it was a very, very strange situation. And we had this sort of Damocles over our head throughout the week, with the prospect of the French government in particular toughening up measures at a sort of rhythm of, well, every couple of days there were new measures being announced and changing the situation on the race, changing what ASO were having to do to adapt.
Yeah, it was a very strange edition of Paris-Nice. Probably the opening few days didn't look all that different to normal. It's not a race that attracts tens of thousands of spectators to the roadside as it makes its way south. Often the finish towns are quite busy, but the measures that were put in place as the race unfolded kept the crowds away from the finish areas. But the race set off without Astana, CSC, Mitchelton Scott, Movistar, Ineos, Jumbo-Visma and UAE Team Emirates. But the flip side of that was that the teams that did go beefed up their rosters a bit. So it was a strong old field, smaller field, 136 riders. But they set off probably not knowing whether it would be Paris-Nice at all, how far it would get towards the south coast.
CSC, Napalm, were team memory card Jack and Jones also there? Or
did I say CSC? I meant CCC. Renouelf. I mean CSC. Not a corrections corner, because CSC didn't start.
Faema, Multani.
I think you meant CCC, didn't you?
I did mean CCC, yeah.
Well, whoever was there, anyway. Whoever was there, chaps, it did turn out to be an absolutely cracking race in very trying and unusual circumstances.
Et on a vu en difficulté Peter Sagan.
Oui, Sagan distancié dans cette brosse.
Et l'accélération de Maximilian Charman, eh oui, qui place un contre immédiatement. C'est bien joué de la part du champion d'Allemagne, qui est un excellent coureur, on le rappelle, hein. Vainqueur d'étape sur le Tour d'Italie. Troisième de Liège-Bastogne-Liège l'an dernier.
Et accélération de Maximilian Schachmann. Off goes Max Schachmann, trying to catch up with Alaphilippe and Thijs Benoot in the court de Nofre-le-Château.
It was for sure one of the key moments of the whole stage race. At this moment, I didn't really think about the GC. I felt really bad doing that day. It was cold and I was tired, but on the last climb I saw that the others are even more tired. So I went with Dylan Teuns we made it to the front and somehow I won. I don't know. It was it's even hard to remember. I think my head already deleted the first kilometers because it was so cold.
Il reste moins d'un kilomètre, less than 1 kilometer to go, and Schachmann again catches up with Tijs Benoot. And victory! Victory goes to rider number 37, Maximilian Schachmann, Bora Hansgrohe. Stage victory and yellow jersey.
Julien Lafilippe qui ne s'imposera pas aujourd'hui et qui ne sera pas le premier Charman. Leader. Maximilian Schachmann qui va déborder, semble-t-il, Dylan Teuns. Maximilian Schachmann, le champion d'Allemagne qui s'impose ici à plaisir devant Dylan Teuns. Troisième place pour Tijs Benoot et Julien Lafilippe. Quatrième, Schachmann sera le premier leader de Paris.
Actually, I was surprised that it's more or less the Malo Jaune, the Tour de France jersey. To have one now, to wear one, it was really... It was a great feeling and I was so happy just to have it at least for one day. I started to think about GC maybe that day when Nizzolo won the sprint, the crosswind day.
Et le peloton est en train de se scinder. The pack is breaking up into several groups, echelons in these final moments of stage 2 to Chalette-sur-Loing. In the front group, we have the likes of number 31, Peter Sagan, and the yellow jersey, number 37, Maximilian Schachmann.
It's more or less like 7 or 8 one-day races, a little bit. For sure, those days are never boring days, but sometimes it's really, let's say, brutal before the key points of that day. Like, it's really difficult to move up to the front to be in the first group. Yeah, I like it if it's really splitted. Sometimes it splits and it's back together and it splits again. And it's really, you know, you have a group of riders in the front who's like, oh, them and they're back, you know. And the other guys there who just came back are like, oh, I don't want to make the same mistake again. I have to go to the front to be in the first group if it splits another time. And that's the moment where you have to fight even harder because... You know, the guys from the second group who just came back, they felt really bad because they were in the second group. They are even more ready to fight harder. You know what I mean? It's always even harder to position yourself to be in the first group another time and another time. So for sure, it's never boring.
Ne figure pas dans le groupe de tête. Je répète, ne figure pas dans le groupe de tête. Not in the leading groups are number 11, Quintana, Arkea, Samsic. Number 21, Thibaut Pinot, Groupama, FDJ. And number 41, Julien Alaphilippe, de Koenig Quickstep.
Peter, I don't know what he would actually say. I have to say, I'm in the bus. I'm also, like, I tell them my opinion, but I'm also listening to the more... experienced guys like Peter first because he won 100 I don't know how many races, so he also had a lot of experience and it's good to listen to him. Like in one day I got another advantage a few seconds and he split it up the group with me in the wheel and he made a really strong move in this moment. Luckily I was on his wheel so I could follow him, and yeah, it helped me a lot that day. Important seconds for the GC.
The phase in the hospital was really tough, above all mentally, because physically I didn't have a lot of symptoms, as I told you before, and it was really difficult mentally because I was in the hospital for 23 in isolation. And I tried to organize my day in a routine, you know, trying to spend the 24 hours doing something, giving a sense to my day. So reading a lot in the first part of the day, try doing some body exercise during the day, because as I told you, I felt really good, above all after 3-4 days. Fortunately, Mauro Gianetti, our team principal, sent to us a ruler with the bike. So I had also the ruler and the bike in the room and a little bit of work. And I spent a lot of time via Skype with my family, with Mauro and the machine, talking about work, just to keep me busy, I guess. Now they were really worried about all of us.
I'm in touch with my coach every day, and we knew that the biggest challenge would be the time trial and would be the mountain stage. So we already discussed what I have to push and what I'm probably able to do and how we do it. This like calms me down, you know, those conversations, because he knows my physiological parts of my body very well, and he knows what's possible. And if he says it's possible, I can really believe it. Yeah, we have a goal together. In the past 2 years, we are both, I am really happy. He's more a little bit surprised how good I develop. And yeah, it always is an extra portion of motivation for the upcoming period, also for this long training period now. I always try to avoid mistakes. Like if there's someone much better and I don't see a way to beat him, I don't need to feel stressed. It's how it is. But if there's someone better, I invest my energy to figure out a plan how to beat him. Yeah, in the end, it's just a bike race. So if I don't win the race, even if I don't win, the earth spins around the other days, the next days. You know, it's not like, it's not the most important thing in the world. It's, of course, for me, it's important. I work a lot for it, but I always try to take things not too serious. It's important to find the right balance. For the future, we'll be even more relaxed now because I already won one race like Paris-Nice now. If you have never won it, it's different. Now you can be even more relaxed. I would like to win it another time, but it's, you feel a little bit less stressed. I started to ride the bike when I was 4 or 5 years old, maybe. Just a little bit, you know. And then I played football, but I was not super successful. I was always talented in riding a bike because it was easy to drop my schoolmates, you know, on the way back home. And even my father was no problem. He had a road bike. I had a mountain bike, and it was not hard to drop him at all. So, yeah. And then one morning, I remember it was a weekend. We listened radio during breakfast, and there was a bike race close to where I lived. Yeah, we went there and we got in touch with the local bike clubs. I had a test training. A week later, I did a little race for the small kids on normal bike. I finished on the podium. And that was the moment I got into regular training. And when I was 12, I had my first regular cycling season. Races every weekend, almost every weekend. Yeah. First in Hohenschönhausen. Then my parents, they built a house just out of the city. Then my parents got divorced back to Hohenschönhausen, or like in both places. After school, I moved to Erfurt for like the best German U23 team was based there, but you had to live there to do training together. Like it was a central system. So I moved to Erfurt to join the team. I raced there, and 3.5 years later, I moved back to Berlin, and then I lived in Köpenick.
And here's a very important message from the race organization due to the current situation and the ongoing pandemic. New security rules have been put in place on this edition of Paris-Nice. The barriers will be a lot longer on the start and finishing zones. And sadly, fans are no longer authorized to come to the starts and to the finishes.
We talked about the whole situation, and you always have different opinions because of different persons live the crisis on a different, with a different view, you know. So it's not easy to hold the group together. I think what was pretty new is that it was a new kind of virus. Nobody knew something about it, not a lot. It was pretty new, so. Yeah, we thought it's not our responsibility, you know, to know if it's safe for everybody. It's up to the RSO and authorities in the region of France at this moment, because we are racing every day and we don't have the time to look up about the virus and everything. I gave the responsibility to RSO and to the organizers and tried to focus on the race. And we also listened to our doctor. At that moment, you already saw that is or not dangerous for young and healthy people. That's the reason I was never worried about myself. It's more like a responsibility to not infect anybody who has a bigger risk.
Il reste maintenant moins de 3 km à parcourir. Moins de 3 km à parcourir dans cette sixième étape de Paris-Nice. Et chute! Chute du maillot jaune! Chute du maillot jaune, Maximilian Schachmann!
I heard that the rule isn't 100% clear, so it's a little bit up to the commissaires. And when I saw the commissaire, I think he was even scared in his car going down that descent. So for him was not even a question mark behind the decision, because I made a mistake, but I also studied the road book and I paid a lot of attention in the two marked corners, but this one wasn't marked and I was not the only one who was going straight there. So it was also a mistake. It's so dangerous to say, guys, okay, go down there for, you know, fighting for GC victory, fighting for the stage victory, without having seen this descent before. So in my opinion, you also don't need to build such a finish into a stage race. I mean, if it's a one-day race, it's different because you are there. You can ride the descent 1, 2, 3 times and you know what you can expect. In the end, that's a more fair situation in the race, because if you cannot follow, it's up to your technical skills. But also the other guys in front of me, like Julio, said that he almost crashed. So he said he also just made it in the last moment. It's dangerous. I was happy that the commissaire had the same opinion about it.
And the yellow jersey, Maximilian Schachmann, back on his bike and riding. Let me insist on the fact that the crash occurred in the final 3 kilometers. I repeat, the crash occurred in the final 3 kilometers. Maximilian Schachmann will be given the final time of the group he was in when he crashed.
I have always the hope to be negative every time I got a swap. I got 12 swap during my isolation. Every time I got the hope to be negative and come back to Italy. But in the same way, I was happy because I was in the best country in the world to try to that they can take care of me. I was reading a lot of news about Italy. And honestly, in UAE, we got the best care that we could. I did 12 swap. It was impossible in Italy to get so many swap for an asymptomatic coronavirus infected. And in the same way, a colleague of mine that got the intensive care for some days because it was a little bit heavier, his kind of virus, was treated in the best way, I think, we could. I was worried because I heard the news, above all during the end of my isolation, the flight. I couldn't find flight to come back home.
Bonjour à tous. Un message important de l'organisation de Paris-Nice. An important message from race organization to let you know that due to the current situation and the coronavirus pandemic, the race organization has decided that the 2020 Paris-Nice will finish after stage 7 at La Colmiane. Stage 8 will therefore be cancelled. I repeat, stage 8 will be cancelled. Bonjour à tous et bienvenue sur cette dernière étape de Paris-Nice, la 7e étape entre Nice et Val-de-Blore-La Colmiane, 166,5 km à parcourir. And welcome to what will finally be the final stage of Paris-Nice, stage 7 between Nice and Val-de-Blore-La Colmiane, 166.5 km of racing today, and the yellow jersey still on the shoulders of rider number 37, Maximilian Schachmann, Bora Hansgrohe.
The plan was to approach the climb with a bigger group, not with someone in the breakaway who could win the race. Anacono. He accelerated straight into the climb. It was really hard the first 3K. Nairo looked back a few times, but we were all close together and he told him, okay, stop it. So I think he even tried it, but he didn't see a good chance. That's why they stopped the move. And in the end, I knew that like a steady speed could be the best solution for me. And Felix helped me in the beginning of the climb. So I told him, go a good pace, but not too fast, so that I could always react. That's what we did. And the last 3 kilometers were pretty hard. When Nairo attacked, I was a little bit sweating in the moment, even more, because I thought, okay, hopefully nobody tries to follow him. But when I saw that nobody even made a little reaction, nothing, I knew, okay, that's a good sign, because everybody feels similar to me. So he could go, and we had our own race behind him. And the last 3 kilometers were really, really hard. With all the attacks of Thibaut Pinot. Higuita also tried it once, I think. And I knew that I have to stick on the wheel, because once I would have a gap, they would ride together against me. So I knew that I really have to try to stay with them as long as possible. That was really hard. I had it a few times before, similar. The pain intensity was similar. Maybe it was a bit longer this time.
I got the first negative test 1 week before leaving the hospital. But the problem was that in the second swap, you have to get 2 negative tests in a row in 24 hours. I was negative the first one, positive the second one, the first time. The second time, again, negative the first one, positive in the second one. I went really crazy in that period, because it was the first time that the second swap became positive after the negative of the first one. Finally, after 2 of that, I got 2 negative tests in a row in 24 hours, and I was free to leave. 26th of March.
Et attention, parce que les 30 secondes, elles y seront peut-être sur la ligne d'arrivée. Paris-Nice va se jouer à coups de seconde, comme souvent ces dernières années. Et Charman est peut-être en train de tout perdre.
Ah, quel numéro, hein, Tige Benoît, les mains en bas du guidon.
La poisse, vainqueur de Paris-Nice 2020, Charman, et puis, après, il décroche.
Okay, it was just one climb, you know, it was not the steepest one, but it was a really long one. So, in the end, you did quite a lot of elevation in that climb. So I think that's always the most important thing, to classify a climb. I felt quite good doing the climb, so I was not suffering the whole climb. That's already a good sign, and I think I don't miss a lot to not to survive it easily, but to not go over a certain limit to arrive with the best. And as I told you, I felt already better, or I was better in the doing the training after Paris-Nice, like 2 weeks after, 3 weeks after. Yeah, that's good to see.
No flight, and I was in contact with the embassy, Italian embassy. In the final, we got a flight from the Swiss embassy, honestly, coadjuvated by the Italian embassy too, for some Italians where some slots, some seats in a flight to Zurich. And we got that flight the 5th of April. From Zurich, we flew to Italy the day after.
Il va gagner. Charman va gagner Paris-Nice parce que Benoît a légèrement coincé dans les 500 derniers mètres. La troisième place et les 4 secondes de bonification pour Thibaut Pinot. Higuita, Nibali et Charman gagnent Paris-Nice, mais Dieu qu'il aura souffert.
12 secondes ouais, de retard pour Charman sur.
I enjoyed it. In the first moment, it was a bit different. Maybe a little bit less attention. After a few days. You know, even the Corona topic was a bit, how you say, monotone, like boring, you know. So journalists were like, oh, what happened beside Corona? And I was actually the guy who won the last Vuelta race. So everybody called me. So I had quite a lot of attention over a longer period this time. Mostly it's like, okay, Paris-Nice, then for another 5 days, it's interesting. And afterwards, there's already the next race where all the attention goes to. And that's different because it was the last race for a longer period. And that's, I think, the main change for this race.
April 5, and I spent one night in Zurich waiting for the connection to Italy. And so I got finally home the April 6th. Yeah, it was a so strange feeling. In the first situation, we were really scared. We knew that we were negative with an antibody too, because now we have also antibody. But we were scared to be also now. Honestly, I'm not feeling really good when I'm so close to other people that I don't know. The first feeling was of happiness for sure when I got on the plane, because I was sure that the nightmare was over. My mind was absolutely already in the moment when I could meet my family, my wife and my children.
Of course, I wanna race as soon as possible again. Or I am still really happy that I won one stage race I did, and the other I did, I finished second. The best case would have been to win both. And especially I increased my form after Paris-Nice. So I did a test and training, I was even better. That was the whole plan for the season, and it worked pretty well. But that doesn't feel like I wasted it. Of course, you work a lot, and you never know if it works, what you do in training. So it's the same situation for everybody, so it doesn't feel like it's wasted, because I cannot change things like the coronavirus. It's good to know that the Tour de France starts end of August, the earliest, so it's good to know that already. I don't really think about whether we race or we don't race, because it doesn't help me. For the moment, we know that we probably race, so that's my goal, and I'm working for that goal. Like for us, for sure it's possible to race without fans. I think it's a big challenge for the ASO to make sure there are no fans. But this is, again, it's not my task to make sure that it happens like this. I think they have to release a good plan if they want to do it like that. But I think in the end, people say it's just sport and it's not so important. Of course, it's not important to basically live, you know, but entertainment is also always a little bit important for people, you know. They want to get entertained when they get back home from work or whatever. To strengthen the society and the group, you know, you have to give them some entertainment also. So just if it's possible to do it, you know, and if nobody is risked with, you know, health and everything, it would be good to present some sports if possible. And even just in TV, I think it's for sure a ghost tour would be better than a virtual Tour de France, in my opinion.
The Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport, our longtime sponsors, for their support of the Cycling Podcast. You can get 25% off at scienceandsport.com with the code, remember this now, Daniel, SISCP25.
SISCP25.
If you were riding our Giro, Daniel, you'd be using that to stock up on your Science and Sport products. They are powering me around our Giro. Well, powering might be an exaggeration, but they're getting me to the finish of most stages. Thank you to Science and Sport for their support of the podcast. Very grateful indeed to them. Well, we heard from Max Schachmann there on his win at Paris. We also heard the voice of Seb Piquet, a familiar voice, of course, and a voice that, to me, when I hear that voice crackling through the radio, It brings a race to vivid life for me. It tells me that we're at a big race, and very evocative. So nice to relive Paris. I think I remember when we spoke about Paris in the weekly podcast after the race, I think we all felt, you know, this could be it for a while. That was one reason why we enjoyed the race so much. It was also a great race, but there was almost a sense of nostalgia even at the time, wasn't there? And now, sort of thinking back to it, being reminded of it. And, you know, Max Schachmann, he's a very appealing young guy. First kind of came to our attention a couple of years ago, not least because he won a stage of the Giro d'Italia in 2018. We'll return to that in a moment or two, but he's a bright guy. He was at Quick Step, moved to Bora Hansgrohe, a natural fit, obviously, as a German there, and a really talented rider who's capable of winning lots of races and lots of different terrain.
He is a very talented rider, Rich, but just thinking about Paris-Nice, and well, we debated at the time, and many other people have debated whether the race should have taken place or not, but it was quite special to be there and just to experience such an unusual race. And when the other day you were doing your reading from the Dino Buzzati account of the 1949 Giro, there was something that sort of resonated with my experience of Paris-Nice. And when Buzzati talked about the strange sort of comradeship and camaraderie that wasn't there between the press and the riders during the race, but then when suddenly everyone sort of stepped out of the race bubble, the Giro bubble, and into sort of civilian life at the end of the race, it was there. You know, everyone had this, you know, this sense of kind of solidarity, of having experienced something together. I felt that at Paris-Nice during the race in particular. And then on the last day, so when it was all done and dusted, Schachmann had won, and, you know, it was a fantastic performance on the mountaintop finish that day. And, you know, as I think we heard there, a bit of an epiphany for him, because he felt that it's really kind of opened his eyes to what he might achieve in the future in Grand Tours. But yeah, that night there was a real kind of an end of term feeling about it, but obviously, you know, with the sort of anxiety hanging over all of us, and there was a sense that, you know, we'd been through something quite trying together, journalists, everyone involved on the race, and we were all sort of stepping back into a world, or stepping out of the race and into a world which was going to be quite unfamiliar and very uncertain. And just on Schachmann, Rich, he's a fascinating character, very charismatic, interesting backstory, probably not your typical cyclist. I mean, his parents were physics teachers, I think. Very clever lad. Got sort of a straight A student in his sort of Abi, which is the German equivalent of A levels. Grew up in Berlin, in an area of Berlin called Lichtenberg, which most people know for two things: the IKEA, the huge IKEA there, where everyone goes to buy their furniture in Berlin, and the Stasi Museum. It's one of the big attractions in Berlin. It's well outside Berlin, actually, but so all of the old kind of Stasi files, or what could be salvaged when the wall fell in 1989, was salvaged and pieced together. And if you make a request to go and see someone's Stasi files, then that's where you go to do it. And there's yeah, fantastic museum there. But Max grew up 800 meters away, and he's never been to the museum, he told me.
Has he been to the IKEA?
I'm sure he's been to the IKEA.
And in are the files, the declassified Stasi files, stored in IKEA shelving unit?
Billy that's bookcases. The big question. Come on.
It's not the first time that's come up. Oh, dear.
He yeah, you say charismatic, Daniel. He's also quite gauche, I think. You know, there's a sort of, I thought that in the Giro press conference from 2018. Very, and I spoke to him at the Tour de France last year as well, when it was Bora Hansgrohe. Very, very kind of eager to please, I think, and chatty and friendly. You know, you say that Grand Tour potential. I mean, Paris-Nice is traditionally a sort of good proving ground for guys who want to make that transition. I think he'd have had a hard time on that final stage had that been held, you know?
I think he would disagree. I mean, he said that he thought that suited him even better, the last stage. But
he was third in a really pretty tough Liège-Bastogne-Liège in 2019.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that was a really underestimated the amount of climbing in that race, kind of that got overlooked in all of our kind of giddiness regarding the new city centre finish. And well, they came over the top of that final climb. I was on there. They were all pretty destroyed, but he looked, you know, he looked fit and ready to race. And I don't know, maybe he's a, you know, someone who goes well when the races get really tough and hard, and you know, a stage racer, a Grand Tour stage racer in the making.
And he's the one. He's to my mind, he's probably the first big German rider who doesn't seem, or hasn't kind of come from the Or he's not affected by the shadow of the dark years, the desperate years in German cycling. I mean, I always felt that although John Degenkolb and Marcel Kittel have done a fantastic job of sort of giving German cycling a presentable face again, and also, you know, addressing some of the issues arising from the Jan Ullrich generation and the Eric Zabel generation, the question has always, well, the air has always been thick with that question, you know, how do they situate themselves in relation to the Ullrich generation? And it was really sort of an inescapable question.
And quite a burden for them, you felt, as well. I mean, quite a lot for their shoulders to carry.
I think so. And even when you ask Max Schachmann about that generation, the Ullrich generation and Zabel generation, he doesn't sort of cower in the corner, or he doesn't even trot out some sanitized, sterile PR soundbite. He's quite comfortable speaking about that, but it's also not something that he feels really affects him or needs to affect him too much.
Well, he was three when Jan Ullrich won the Tour de France. And of course, I mentioned Schachmann won a summit finish at Prato Nervoso in 2018, albeit from a breakaway. A very significant day in that Giro, won eventually, of course, by Chris Froome after Simon Yates led for so long. But that day and that climb, and it's the reason why Schachmann's win that day was perhaps overlooked. That was the first sign of kind of weakness from Simon Yates. And we will be returning to that Giro and Stage 19 in particular the following day in an episode next week. We've spoken to all the main protagonists in that stage, but let's just hear, let's just look back on that day, the day that Max Schachmann won a stage of the Giro, but we were slightly kind of looking elsewhere, I suppose. Let's hear first from the opening to that night's episode when Daniel and I were kind of looking the other way as Max Schachmann won. Then we'll hear from Chris Froome, who went on to win the Giro, and from Chris Juul-Jensen, Simon Yates' teammate at Mitchelton Scott.
Well, Rich, colpo di scena, as they say in Italy. What does that mean?
I don't know, Daniel, but it looks like a casino to me.
Yeah, it's very dramatic. Oh no, someone's gone the wrong way. Froome's gone the wrong way. What's he doing? Yates is just...
I'd be captured.
Well, I'm not sure I'll ever get a job as a commentator. In fact, this could be the end of my brief TV career. Lopez has just come over the line. But we thought this would be a good climb for Dumoulin, didn't we? But it was really Chris Froome that lit the blue touch paper or Team Sky with Wout Poels. And Dumoulin has just hung on the back, but very good move. And
good day for Dumoulin. Yates has cracked a little bit. There's no other way. I mean, this sets up the last 2 days.
Is this going to be 3, 4, 5?
But he, more than that, Daniel, he looks in difficulty, and he's been dropped by the Carapaz group. And he's coming in with, looks like, Mikel Nieve here. A difficult day, and it's what we've always said.
The Dutch journalists are already mauling.
But this Giro is not over, is it?
No, and as we said last night, Rich, these stages with just one big climb at the end, often they look quite innocuous compared to the big multiple mountain days, but they cause a lot of damage. Should we go and try and speak to some riders?
Let's go.
He didn't lose much time there at all, but was that highly significant to you that he did get dropped towards the top?
That was where the cracks began to show, I think, for Simon, because there was a bit of excitement towards the top of that climb and a few attacks. All of a sudden, Simon just wasn't there anymore. He wasn't on the wheel. And I think that was opened up that whole question of, hold on, has he suddenly got sick, or is he just running out of steam at this point? Because he's been able to follow everyone's attacks up until now. And this was the first time that he wasn't able to follow, and he didn't lose much, but it was enough just to show everyone that there was a slight weakness, and that was enough to give people hope. And I think that changed my mentality completely for that next day on Finestra on stage 19, finishing up in Bardonecchia. And it just made me think, this is probably one of the hardest stages of the race. It's just three big climbs.
There was a sense of unease, obviously. It was also the feeling of it's out of our control in a way, because stage 18, I mean, again, beauty of pro cycling, but especially doing a Grand Tour, there's so many things that can't be explained. Also, the idea of you do a three-week Grand Tour, and personally, I come out of it better than when I started, which makes no sense either. But you hear a lot of riders talk about that. But a guy like Simon, he just dominated for so many stages. And then it was like flicking a switch, you know, when you saw it from the outside, that all of a sudden it was just, the magic was gone. I think we were all sort of hoping that it wasn't true. But maybe we all went to bed with sort of the feeling of, oof. But a pretty cool experience, because we all desperately wanted him to win the Giro. He was so close, and it would have meant so much for the entire team and everyone involved. But no one finished in Rome feeling like we'd been robbed of something, or we knew it hadn't turned out the way we'd expected, but we still felt that we'd been part of a special grand tour. And that to me is also something that, you know, I enjoy, means a lot in this team, is that you really value this team effort. And when things go as we planned, that sort of overshadows more or less everything else.
Well, that was a little flavour of an episode that we'll be playing next week in the final week of our Giro. I think it's our penultimate episode, in fact. One to look forward to.
Hungary feels a long time ago now, doesn't it?
Already it does, doesn't it? Yeah, receding in the rear view mirror. What have we got coming up tomorrow, though, Daniel?
Well, we're staying in the Veneto region and we're heading through Prosecco country at the start of the stage. We are going to be sort of skirting Tiramisu country, or at least one half of the great Tiramisu divide. Richard, I can see your eyes glazing over.
As fiercely kind of contested as the Coppi Bartoli divide.
Very much so, very much so. Well, we might revisit the famous Tiramisu podcast, World Cup podcast tomorrow.
I'm going to be making the Tiramisu, Daniel. I might even put some aioli in it for you.
Oh, God. And then we will be heading up Monte Grappa. So maybe we'll finish the day with a lovely Grappa. We're going to, I think there are 9 ways up Monte Grappa, and we're going to go up, or you guys will be going up one of the steepest ways, a road that's steeper than any of the ascents of Monte Grappa previously used in the Giro, which you'll be delighted about, I'm sure.
Just going back to Tiramisu, I wonder if there's an Italian version of Daniel Friba, a real Daniele Fribarancini, who kind of argues passionately with his Italian friends about eaten mess.
And whether
it should have strawberries or raspberries, and what kind of cream to use.
Tiramisu, of course, literally means pull me up. So hopefully there'll be someone there to pull you up, Monte Grappa.
Yes, excellent. That sounds great. Well, until then, thank you very much, Daniele Fribarancini.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, Rich.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.